Today is Monday, February 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, if lawmakers don't come up with a budget compromise by Friday, the U.S. could see another government shutdown. Another Democrat joins a crowded field of candidates running for president in 2020.
We are tired of the shutdowns and the showdowns, of the gridlock and the grandstanding.
A growing humanitarian crisis in Venezuela as the president there refuses to allow in aid. And women representing at this year's Grammy Awards. And we remember a late great female musician who took home 5 trophies almost a decade ago. But we start now with the growing list of Democrats who want to be president in 2020. Amy Klobuchar, a 3-term senator from Minnesota, is the latest to join that list. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Supporters stood outside in a snowy, cold Minneapolis to hear Klobuchar say,
I am running for you.
The most prominent Midwestern candidate so far says climate change, gun laws, and making health care more affordable are some of the issues at the top of her agenda.
I will focus on getting things done. That's what I've done my whole life. And no matter what, I'll lead from the heart.
Klobuchar did not utter Trump's name, but she did bemoan foreign policy by tweet and said fear-mongering and hate must stop.
Klobuchar says she hopes a successful presidential campaign would bring Midwestern states that President Trump won in 2016 back into the Democrats' column in 2020. She is entering, as we said, a very crowded race for the Democratic nomination. Time is running out for President Trump and congressional lawmakers to compromise on a border security plan that would prevent yet another partial government shutdown this Friday, just days after Trump repeated his call for $5.7 billion in funding for a U.S.-Mexico border wall. A bipartisan committee working on a compromise deal on border security. But one Republican senator says talks with Democrats have broken down over immigration detention policies. While a number of Republicans in Congress have made it clear they wouldn't embrace another shutdown, White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday he can't rule it out.
You cannot take a shutdown off the table, and you cannot take 5.7 off the table. But if you end up someplace in the middle, yeah, then what you probably see is a president say, yeah, okay, and then I'll go find the money someplace else.
BOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
Stalled traffic at airports, shuttered museums, and unpaid government workers. Scenes from a partial government shutdown that could be repeated if the president and Congress don't reach a deal on his demand for a border wall.
Now is the time for Congress to show the world that America is committed to ending illegal immigration and putting the ruthless coyotes, cartels, drug dealers, and human traffickers out of business.
The president agreed to fund the government for 3 additional weeks until February 15th, giving a bipartisan committee of lawmakers time to find a compromise. Any deal would have to pass a Democrat-majority House of Representatives and still have the president's signature.
I don't expect much coming out of the committee because I keep hearing the words that we'll give you what you want, but we're not going to give you a wall. And the problem is, if they don't give us a wall, it doesn't work.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has signaled she may be willing to support funding for some border fencing, the latest technology, and more personnel at ports of entry. But Democrats are standing united against funding for the wall Trump supporters want, and the president has repeatedly promised since the days of his presidential campaign.
30% of his base is with him, but 70% of Americans still believe immigration is a good thing for this country. People do not believe we should have a wall at the southern border.
President Trump could accept a compromise to avoid the unpopular options of shutting down the government again or declaring a national emergency at the border to secure funding for a wall.
The president also said he has a responsibility for the safety of all Americans. And I don't think anybody questions his legal authority to declare a national emergency.
Many Republicans do not want to see him take that route, since the declaration would likely trigger court battles over his use of presidential authority. But with a looming 2020 presidential contest, both Democrats and Republicans are aware the political cost of giving in to the other side. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. South Korea and the U.S. reach a payment deal on U.S. troops. U.S.-backed forces in Syria push to oust the last of the IS group. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, heads to Central Europe in a U.S. re-engagement. And an unkept pledge of Nigeria's health care. Find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. The possibility that President Donald Trump might resort to using military force to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is raising concerns about the potential cost in lives and unintended consequences of committing American troops to another foreign conflict. But European and Latin American leaders are calling for dialogue and elections to solve a deepening crisis in Venezuela. They're warning against rash intervention in the country. U.S. Special Envoy for Venezuela Elliot Abrams tells reporters that the time for talk with Maduro has long passed, except to negotiate his departure.
Instead of trying to accommodate Maduro through contact groups or dialogue, we urge countries to recognize Juan Guaido as interim president and join us in responding to his call for immediate international humanitarian assistance to meet the needs of the Venezuelan people.
Maduro is refusing to allow aid into the country as a humanitarian crisis deepens. Food, fuel, and many basic goods are in severely short supply, and inflation is out of control. A giant tanker and two large shipping containers are sitting in the middle of the bridge between Venezuela and Colombia. It's blocked. It's being blocked from attempting delivery. Opposition leader Juan Guaido, who has declared himself interim president and has been backing the U.S. and has the backing of the U.S. and several other nations, requested the aid, warning that many Venezuelans face severe risks without international help. Earlier, I talked to Carlos Moreo, Venezuelan associate professor at the School of Politics and International Relations at the Australian National University. So how dire is this situation?
I mean, the situation in Venezuela is, of course, dramatic. And we've seen this now reported on the media. We've seen footage, and we've also heard Venezuelans speak about this, not only in the last couple of weeks, but really over the last year and a half, 2 years or so. The crisis affects all, Venezuelans from all walks of life. And it's an economic crisis, but of course it's also a social crisis. So there's food shortages and the hospitals are understaffed and they're also lacking essential medical supplies, etc. And so the crisis is, of course, real and dramatic. But the situation on humanitarian aid is kind of more complex. The government of Maduro has always stated, perhaps cynically, that humanitarian intervention is really just a pretext for a military intervention, right? So they've always countered that. And you can see, I guess, from the government's perspective, how allowing humanitarian aid to enter the country would be a kind of admission or recognition of the Maduro government's failure to address the plight of the people and to address the crisis. On the other hand, kind of the regional coalition of the group of Lima countries and the U.S., etc., would see humanitarian aid or the happening of humanitarian aid as an important event because it would signal to the world that humanitarian aid was necessary. It would signal to the world that, in fact, yes, there is a crisis and we're not meddling in the country and undermining its sovereignty, but rather by offering humanitarian aid and by having this happen, this is a demonstration of the crisis, something that, of course, the government has repeatedly denied.
U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he really hopes that no foreign forces enter Venezuela. U.S. President Donald Trump said he didn't rule out sending troops in.
Military intervention is certainly a concern. I mean, the strategic game that the opposition is playing here, with Juan Guaido as leader of the National Assembly and sworn in or self-proclaimed, according to some, as interim president, and having the U.S. on side and having, in some sense, a threat of military intervention is ostensibly an important part of their kind of bargaining position and a protection of Guaido. Nevertheless, I mean, military intervention would be catastrophic. It would be absolutely catastrophic for the country. The Venezuelan military is large and, we have militias and, we have kind of different sort of components. We've seen exercises exercises within Venezuela in the last couple of days, you know, where the military have come out and sworn their allegiance to Maduro and kind of stated that, you know, that they would defend the country, etc. You know, these kinds of things are we can expect these things. And fortunately, you know, there are some actors within Venezuela and were also an international actors, you know, so governments who have said that, you know, they don't want military intervention. So, for example, the Grupo de Lima, right, the Lima group, which essentially brings together the Latin American countries such as Colombia, Brazil, Peru, Chile, and others who are supporting the opposition and who are the countries, the Latin American countries that first came out to recognize Guaido. In a recent statement, they one of the points in the communique was that they did not support military intervention. So that's important. It's important that pro-opposition actors such as the Grupo de Lima also come out against military intervention. Now, of course, this means that then the outcome, and this is the outcome that, you know, all the Venezuelans, you know, we would like to see is an outcome that leads us to elections or an outcome that leads us to a legitimate government in some way. And there are avenues for this. And it seems to me that the conference that's going to happen on the 7th of February, so in a couple of days in Montevideo in Uruguay, might be a suitable scenario in which some of these international actors that have sided with the government and sided with the opposition can come together and battle it out, right, and negotiate some kind of outcome that would have to include elections. Like, it would have to include elections or something like a referendum that would then lead to elections. But I do think this has to be the path.
The other factor in all of this is Venezuela is a very oil-rich country and an important one regarding that with the United States and other nations. How does oil factor in to all of this, particularly when it comes to trying to oust Maduro?
Oil is clearly a part of the story. The latest moves we've seen in trying to pressure the government of Maduro to concede power and support Guaido, you know, has to do with U.S. sanctions on PDVSA, right? The U.S. government adopted sanctions on Venezuela's state-owned company, PDVSA, and on Citgo. And National Security Advisor John Bolton said that this would mean freezing up something like $7 billion in assets in the country and mm-hmm. close to $11 billion in revenue. And this would happen as of the 28th of April, so still a few weeks away. But this would essentially mean that the government of Maduro would find it very difficult to fund its programs and very difficult, in fact, to import foodstuff to try and address the crisis of Venezuela. So the sanctions are an important part of the story, and of course, they're trying to affect the resources that the oil company brings into the country. And PDVSA itself has been in crisis as well, right? So, and the sanctions aren't helping, and in fact, these sanctions really add to the sanctions that we had from last year. But the Venezuelan oil company PDVSA has also been in crisis and has seen its production plummeting in the last 2 years. So we're barely an oil-producing state right now.
That's Carlos Moreo, Venezuelan associate professor at the School of Politics and International Relations at the Australian National University. Hopes for a peace plan in Afghanistan have been waning in recent weeks after top U.S. officials walked back, reports the outlines or an agreement were in place. Still, U.S. officials and the Taliban continue to meet, with both at least paying lip service to the idea that all is not lost. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports the top American negotiator believes there is a chance something can get done before Afghanistan's next election in 5 months.
After decades of war, 17 involving U.S. forces, hopes that the hour of peace with the Taliban in Afghanistan is almost at hand.
They say they want legitimacy, they have learned from their mistakes of the past, that they want to be not isolated, on be a pariah state.
U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, on Friday called such words encouraging, and he said there's even a chance for a final peace deal before Afghans next go to the polls.
Between now and July, there is sufficient time, I believe, where we could reach an agreement. But at least if we have significant progress, that will have a good impact.
But for that to happen, negotiators will need to answer critical questions, like when will U.S. forces finally be gone? For the Taliban, it can't happen soon enough.
We are in negotiation with the American side, and we are trying that the American forces should go out as soon as it is possible.
In return, the U.S. wants assurances the Taliban will not let terror groups like Al-Qaeda or Islamic State use Afghanistan as a base. While the Taliban have offered such guarantees, Pentagon officials doubt they can deliver.
A significant or sudden drawdown of our counterterror ability or footprint would be a risk.
Complicating matters, U.S. President Donald Trump has made it clear he wants U.S. troops to come home sooner rather than later.
So here we find ourselves looking at this point for an exit. But we want an exit that at least leaves some semblance of order rather than an invitation to chaos.
That fear of chaos weighs heavily on the mind of many Afghans, wary of both the U.S. and the Taliban.
If the Taliban choose a better and soft policy for youth, we will be happy. But if it is a repeat of the 2001 era, then we are not happy with it.
Khalilzad says in the end, negotiations may come down to whether the Taliban can appreciate that the country they once ruled has changed.
The message that they have given me is that they understand that they cannot go back.
Many Afghans are hoping, one way or another, promises of peace will finally be realized. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
As the deadline approaches for all sides to agree on a plan for the UK to leave the European Union and Brexit, just over a month away, the British government asked lawmakers Sunday to give Prime Minister Theresa May more time to work her divorce deal with the European Union. Britain is due to leave the EU on March 29th, but Parliament has rejected May's divorce bill, leaving the Prime Minister to seek changes from the EU. The UK's bid for last-minute changes has exasperated EU leaders who insist the legally binding withdrawal agreement can't be changed. And while lawmakers argue over a deal for an orderly exit, there are concerns that a no-deal Brexit could cause potential chaos. British officials are reportedly reviving Cold War emergency plans when it comes to getting the British royal family out in case of riots. London-based reporter Amy Gutman joins us now. Amy, what are you hearing about this?
At the moment, it's important to note that this is actually only talk for now. In fact, some are calling it Project Fear, saying that it's inspiring panic among people. But because Brexit negotiations haven't yet led to an agreement between both the British Parliament and the EU, security officials, among others, are making contingency plans in the event that there is a no-deal Brexit. So various public and private sector organizations are making these contingency plans, including shortages of essentials like food and medicine. In this case, security officials are actually drawing up plans for a worst-case scenario in which they say there could be riots on the streets of London. Now, this is possible. Most people don't imagine this is actually going to come to be. But of course, when protecting the royal family, and particularly the 94-year-old queen, it's important to take every precaution.
So are there any details of the evacuation plan?
The original Cold War plan involved relocating members of the royal family to various country houses to protect them from enemy forces during the Cold War. Now, obviously, that's not a current threat, but some have suggested that they would be moved to safe locations away from London. However, even this point is contentious, as a senior MP of the Conservative Party has said that the plan was not only sparking panic, but he also pointed out that senior royals stayed in London during the bombing in World War II, and that the notion that they would flee merely because of some riots, because of a no-deal Brexit, was preposterous. So, like most things connected to Brexit in the UK, there are multiple points of view, and most of them opposing.
What are the plans in the extreme event that there are riots over Brexit?
Two British newspapers have quoted unnamed sources from the government's cabinet office, which usually handles these sensitive kinds of issues. And they have said that emergency plans dating back to the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are actually being repurposed effectively to relocate the royal family in this worst-case scenario. Some are saying, again, the very mention of this plan is propaganda to raise fear levels around Brexit, to hope that people will come to a deal, an agreement. But a senior government source was quoted saying that this very much falls under the security remit, no matter how far-fetched it may actually seem.
That's London-based reporter Amy Gutman. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. When a language becomes extinct, a culture disappears and a community loses its identity. That's happening more often than many can imagine. According to the UNESCO Atlas of the World's Languages in Danger, at least 43% of the estimated 6,000 languages spoken in the world are endangered. Faiza El-Masri tells us about a nonprofit in New York City that's on a mission to inspire people to save their native languages from extinction and bring the dead ones back to life. Faith Lapidus narrates.
33-year-old Theron Kolokwe lives in Windhoek, Namibia. Like other educated young people there, he speaks a number of languages on a daily basis, especially English and Afrikaans, but not his native language.
My native language is Suvia. I think in my language, I dream in my language. It's the language that I was born into. I didn't have a choice to speak it.
Suvia is spoken by a minority in the northern part of Namibia and other areas. 2 years ago, Kolokwe started documenting it. The idea came to him while he was watching YouTube.
Randomly, a video of someone speaking their native tongue popped up. And then when I opened it, it caught my curiosity. And then I was like, I want to also hear my language and the languages from my country and then Southern Africa in particular.
Kolokwe is one of dozens of volunteers working with WikiTongues, a nonprofit in New York City that helps people from all over the world preserve native languages that have been shrinking and disappearing.
That's really not an accident of history. It's because over the 1800s and 1900s, virtually every government in the world relentlessly worked to forcibly assimilate minority cultures.
Daniel Borgwer Udell is WikiTongues' co-founder.
I think that no one would suggest that we need to be religiously or culturally or ethnically homogenous, so why should we be linguistically homogenous? At the end of the day, it's a question of what kind of world we want to live in, a colorful one or a gray one.
The volunteer-based group began in 2016 as an open internet archive of every language in the world. On WikiTongues' YouTube channel, videos of oral histories are available in different languages.
Language revitalization at the end of the day is something that has to be done by the community from the ground up. There is no way an outside organization can save someone's language for them. We've had over 1,500 contributors from about 70 different countries. We've had people from India who record, you know, dozens of languages beyond their own. We have another volunteer from Scotland who is one of the last speakers of a variety of Scottish Gaelic that he's in the process of reclaiming and revitalizing, building a dictionary for them.
WikiTongues provides its volunteers with help and support and inspiration.
Languages can actually be brought back by the community after they've gone extinct. You know, Hebrew is a really good example of this, where it went extinct in the 4th century BCE and was revived in the 1800s and is now once again the mother tongue of half the world's Jewish population. One of our tribal partners here in the U.S., the Tunica-Biloxi tribe of Louisiana, has over the past couple of years been building a really lively language revival in their community, and their language originally went extinct in the 40s.
Such revival success stories give volunteers like Theron Kolokwe hope that his efforts can save Suvia and other African languages from extinction.
I'm going to try to record as many African languages as possible, especially from the southern part of Africa. So I want to document it, create a dictionary, and maybe even go as far as creating a curriculum for it and let it be taught in schools. So I want the world to know about my language. I want to promote it so that generations to come can speak it fluently, because there's a huge influx of Western languages around here, especially in Namibia, because it's a language that we all learn in school. It's a language of business, it's a language of government, and people are neglecting their native languages.
With awareness and technology, WikiTongues puts people in a better position to save and revive their native languages, making the world more colorful and culturally diverse. For writer Faiza El-Masri, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
On Sunday night was the music industry's biggest night of the year. The 61st annual Grammy Awards were held at the Staples Center in Los Angeles. Lady Gaga won Best Song for Visual Media for Shallow, the song from A Star is Born, which also won a Golden Globe and is nominated for an Oscar. Singer Alicia Keys hosted.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no.
Women were strongly represented this year. That's in contrast to last year's ceremony, where male acts dominated in nominations, and the only woman competing for the top award, Lorde, didn't even get a chance to perform on stage. This year, though, women led the way in nominations for big categories like Album of the Year and Best New Artist. And 11 years ago, at the 50th annual Grammy Awards, the late British female singer Amy Winehouse won big at the awards for her song Rehab, which referenced her own struggles with addiction and her refusal to seek treatment. That year, Winehouse picked up 5 trophies.
But I know.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
We'll be right back. This is VOA News. I'm Tom.